And now our main topic today, parenting in the year 2014. Jennifer Senior is the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. And this is a book that seeks to explain the paradox suggested by the title, All Joy and No Fun. The book grew out of a much-discussed cover article that she wrote for New York Magazine, where she is a contributing editor, that highlights studies showing that parents are not as happy as their childless peers. Jennifer Senior will be in town tomorrow night to speak at the library, but she's with us right now, and I think it's probably fair to point out that she has a family of her own. And Jennifer Senior, welcome to Up to Date. So nice to have you.
So nice to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk about the title of the book, Jennifer, All Work and No Fun. You're driving at what exactly there?
All joy and no fun. All work, you know, might be something else, but what am I driving at there? Well, I had the good sense to steal that phrase from a friend of mine who
The best phrases are always stolen, Jennifer.
Aren't they? I know. It's just a question of being a very shrewd thief. I asked him how he was enjoying new fatherhood. I did not yet have a family of my own at that time. And those were the five words he gave me as his answer. It was all joy and no fun. And I remember thinking, like, it was very powerful. It's a very sticky, adhesive phrase. You know, it never leaves you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a few years later, as I was doing another story for New York Magazine, I came across this, you know, kind of very robust body of data that suggests that parents are certainly no happier than non-parents, and in some cases might even be less so. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. I would love to write about that, but I don't have a family, and I don't think it would really make me a particularly credible narrator, and I don't think I'd be able to even explore it fully. So once I did, I decided that it really did demand interrogation. And, you know, a lot of these studies really do miss what the joy is of parenting and the kind of, kind of bottomless connection we have to our kids. And, you know, they miss some very basic things. I mean, parents are less likely to take their own lives, for example. That's very profound.
Because they can't do it with the kids.
You could have a cynical response like the one that you're having, which is you might choose to frame it differently, which is to say that they have more meaning in their lives and that they have a reason to wake up in the morning. But yes, there are probably, you know, it's probably a multi-determined response. You are right.
Yes. And I should point out here that your book talks a lot about the challenges that parents face these days, but you also talk a lot about the joys of parenting. I don't want to forget that aspect of what this book is all about.
Bless you, because some people do, and it drives me down, or, you know, around
yes.
the twist. But
yeah.
Yes, I mean, and in fact, I sort of, in a funny way, ditched the question of happiness altogether. I mean, I would talk about joy because I think those things are not really as joy and transcendence and meaning are not as easily measured by social scientists. What I tried to do throughout the book was, you know, it's organized chronologically, and I look at how kids affect their parents at every stage of their development. So when they're toddlers, when they're in elementary school, when they're adolescents, and I try and kind of troubleshoot, like I try and anatomize like what the problems are and why they might be there. And I also try and talk about all the kind of more elusive, beautiful things that social science doesn't have studies for and names for. So I do both. That's right.
You know, I mentioned that this book grew out of your article for New York Magazine, you know, that discussed the studies that have come out that, you know, that show that parents are not as happy as their childless peers. What kind of reaction did you get from that story in New York Magazine?
Here's the truth. I got a really nice reaction to it, in part because it had I'll tell you two reasons. Number one, because it's not like this was like a giant polemic on my part. I wasn't making this case. I was asking why it was a robust finding in social science. I was interrogating it. And in the end, I concluded that social scientists weren't asking all the right questions or sufficiently nuanced questions to get the full picture. They were not asking parents about how many moments of meaning they had in their lives, or about transcendent moments, and all these other unmeasurables. Or actually, they are measurable. It's just that social scientists weren't asking. So I came out on the side saying that this finding is partial. It doesn't tell the whole story. But to the extent that it tells a story, mm-hmm. which is to say that it describes the stress, you know, why is it true? And my conclusion is that kids are not the problem. It was something about parenting right now in 2014, or when I wrote it 2010, that was the problem. It was something about how we parent. So I wasn't laying this at our kids' feet. And that's not a particular – and once you've framed it as like parenting being – at issue and being the problematic thing, then I think that you're not writing, you know, a particularly inflammatory story mm-hmm. anymore. Mm-hmm. And anybody who read it, and particularly anybody who got to the end of it, which seemed to be an awful lot of people, they weren't particularly negative. And let me just also point out, I write a lot about politics for New York Magazine. I've been writing about politics since, you know, I was a kid, mm-hmm. You know, since like 1992, basically, since I got out of school, 1991. I have gotten lots of negative responses to things that I've written in my life about politics in particular, like really ugly, mm-hmm. you know,
I live in that world too, Jennifer. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so you know exactly. Right. So you and I know what ugly is when you write something and there's just this wicked, ugly response to it. I didn't have that. So, you know, I can say sort of slightly jauntily, like, no, it was nothing like when I write a book review for the Times, you know, about a politics book.
Yeah. Well, you know, to the extent that your article for New York Magazine did discuss this idea that parents aren't as happy as their childless peers, you know, what strikes me about that is you don't hear, or at least I don't hear, parents complaining about parenthood all that much. I mean, it's almost like it's taboo to go there. What you do hear is how amazing everybody's kids are and all the incredible summer jobs they have right now, that kind of thing. And you talk in the book about this gap in how we experience things versus how we remember them. Tell mm-hmm. us about that.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, that's one of the loveliest things that I think I found when I was rooting around, you know, the literature on all sorts of stuff. But Daniel Kahneman, who is a Nobel Prize winning, he's a psychologist, but what he really did was pioneer the field of behavioral economics. He has this, he coined this term that we have the experiencing self and we have the remembering self. And the experiencing self is exactly what it sounds like. It's the person who goes about the world doing things in real time. And it turns out that our experiencing selves find parenting pretty stressful. Mm-hmm. Daniel Kahneman has found this in his own work and other studies that he's done. You know, we find it at times boring. We find it at times very stressful. It creates a lot of tension in our marriages sometimes. You know, there's lots of kind of behavioral kind of, you know, we're doing a lot of nagging around our kids. However, if you ask an adult with kids what their greatest sources of happiness are, about 85% of them, this is according to Pew, according to Gallup, according to all sorts of data and research, they will say that it's their kids. Mm-hmm. Because we remember our moments with our kids in a very different way from how we experience them. Mm. And, you know, or we highlight those moments that were just impossibly beautiful, and they occupy a very special place in our memory. And it turns out in a funny way that our identities are really made up mostly of memories, and that's how we think of ourselves. So our remembering selves have kind of disproportionate sway in calling who we are, right, in determining who we are. Yeah. So even like a terrible moment with a kid, you know, it's 2 a.m, your kid's sick, you're just praying for them to fall asleep because you're exhausted and they're uncomfortable. But what you remember years later is the sensation of the kid's arms around your neck mm. and the legs around your stomach, and that like they were a koala bear and you were the tree. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's a very different kind of memory that you store away.
Yeah, interesting. Jennifer Senior is our guest. She's the author of the new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She'll be in town. You can see and hear her tomorrow night, 6:30, at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch at 14 West 10th Street. Go to kclibrary.org to grab a seat and to get some more information about that. Let's get our parents involved here. I just want to point out that Jennifer's book is not a parental advice book. It's really a book about the experience of being a parent. So with that theme in mind, we want to know, so has being a parent been everything you hoped it would be? What's been the biggest challenge for you? Give us a call. 816-235-2888 is our number here. 816-235-2888. So what's been your biggest struggle as a parent, Jennifer?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I'm trying to think if anyone has ever dared ask it. Well, I'm so glad you did.
Here we are. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, what are my biggest? I mean, there are a few. I think, you know, I was older when I had my first kid. I got pregnant at 37, or at my only kid. I, you know, I'm a stepmother already, so I was allowed one. So you know, you get one, my husband said. So you know, I was already older, and so I think adjusting to the before and the after, and this is something that I think lots of women and men struggle with, because if you have a college education, you're going to have your first kid now at 30.3 years old, odds are, if you're a woman, and probably 32.3 if you're a man. So, you know, the difference between the before and the after is so extreme, and you can come and go as you please and observe your own rhythms and do what you want. Irma Bombeck had this great line that she wrote years ago that I still think is really applicable. She said, I haven't been alone in the bathroom since October. And, you know, it's like, I mean, I had, like, the bathroom all to myself until I was 37. And then, oh, my God, never again.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a hard I think, you know, I'll be honest. I think that this is a very robust finding in social science. People argue a lot more with their spouses once their kids come along. And it's for a variety of reasons. In the beginning, you're sleep deprived, so you're not your best self, right? And also, like, the division of labor is just a pain in the neck to kind of organize. You know, we live in a country that, God bless it, has lots of, you know, wonderful things going for it and lots of freedoms for us to determine our own way, but it doesn't offer much social support for parents, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we don't have, like, a subsidized daycare. We don't have, like, long paid maternity leaves, nothing like that, or paternity leaves. So chores and negotiating them become very tense.
And you talk about this in the book. There's no on-the-job training here. You go from one day having the bathroom all to yourself, and the next day you're sharing it with this new creature. And, you know, it's tough because there is no sort of easy entrance, gradual entree into this new world. You're just sort of there one day and off you go.
Bingo. And I'm glad you pointed that out. It sometimes gets overlooked. But for every other major life transition, there is, in fact, a transition period. I mean, if you marry someone, the odds are overwhelming, unless you're in an arranged marriage, that you've dated and perhaps even lived together. If you take a job, you've trained, you might have studied for it for many years in school. When you have a baby, boom. You know, you were like just watching a movie one night and like going out to dinner. And then, you know, the next day, there you are. And you haven't had a whole lot of preparation, particularly in the U.S. We don't have particularly big families now. So it's not like you spent oodles of time necessarily as a child taking care of other children. It's just it's a very abrupt transition. And many sociologists have actually written about this, that this is really one of the only transitions in adult life for which we have almost zero preparation.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Has parenting been everything you hoped it would be? What's been your biggest challenge as a mom or dad? Give us a call again, 816-235-2888. Erica from Lawrence, you're on Up to Date with Jennifer Senior. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Erica.
Hi there.
Welcome.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say that I was the oldest child of four, and I pretty much had to raise them, and so I never thought that I wanted to have children. But I was lucky enough to get married later in life and have a son of my own, and he has brought more fulfillment and joy and happiness to me than I ever thought possible. And I did give up an art career to raise him, but I am getting back into that career. I have to point out that he is so amazing, but he's not a teenager yet. So we'll see what happens as he ages. But it's really the best thing that ever happened to me.
What's been your biggest challenge, Erica?
Being patient and really keeping myself in check and my temper, because I don't want him to inherit that from me, and I don't want to be a bad role model.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what's interesting about that?
Yeah.
Self-regulation, which is to say, you know, restraining our tempers and not yelling and keeping our patience.
Yeah.
Self-regulation is consistently rated by children as being the thing that their parents are worst at.
They would say that about me, I bet, yeah.
I mean, and so don't feel like you're alone. Ellen Galinsky, who is this wonderful woman who runs the family, the Family and Work Institute here in New York, she had this inspired idea about a decade ago, more now, I guess, to survey children, give 1,000 school kids questions, asking them to grade their parents. And she wrote up the results in a book of her own. And across the board, consistently, the worst scores were for self-regulation and controlling temper. And this is if the kids were little or if they were big. Mm-hmm. Everybody bombed on this one. So you're not alone in feeling that way. You're also probably not alone in thinking that your kids, that your son is, if that's what you said, right, a son?
Yes.
I mean, that they can provide these kind of unrivaled moments of kind of transcendence and fulfillment. I think what's hard is that people sometimes don't feel like they can talk about the ways that parenting has disappointed them. I think that, like, in parenting books, we're sort of given two options. We can either be joyous and over the moon and think that this is the best choice we ever made, or we can have terrible postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
And what we can't have is, like, anything in between.
Mm-hmm.
And it's discussing the mixed bag
yes.
that I think is
yes.
hard. And also, you know, I get lots of phone calls that are, you know, and lots of responses and lots of reader responses that are not quite as, like, delighted as yours and are not depressed. They're like, all over the range in the middle, you know? They're just like, I had a great day with him, and I'm really happy that I did this, but I'm feeling uncertain about having given up my career today. Tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
maybe I'll be really happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it just, I get all sorts of answers.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Erica, so good to hear from you, and good luck at self-regulating, okay?
Thanks a lot.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Christy from Overland Park. Christy, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Morning. I just wanted to add that it's kind of been alluded to, but my biggest disappointment with parenting has been my loss of physical autonomy, I guess.
Meaning what exactly, Christy?
My body was no longer my own. Mm. It belonged to my son. You know, I was nursing. I had to be at his beck and call night and day, you know, and it,
yeah.
to a degree. And, you know, you lose the ability to go do the things you want, which, of course, everybody knows before they become a parent. But getting into the thick of it is a totally different story. It was actually quite interesting that I found myself oddly relieved after I was divorced and I split custody 50-50. It's a strange mix of relief in a way and also sadness, but it gave me my physical autonomy back to a degree.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I appreciate your candor,
not,
Christy, by the way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very candid thing to say, and by the way, I've heard it before, and, you know, it's in fact, it depends on where you are. You know, it's easier to admit that in some places where there are more divorced people than others. But I totally appreciate that. And I think it's a very real thing feeling. I mean, I was once talking to a mother who just said very plaintively to me, I just feel like my own self has gotten lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
that's the other extreme,
I've felt that
right?
way in the past. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That, like, you know, I mean, you know, your previous caller was talking about feeling transcendently, like this was the greatest source of fulfillment. This mother was saying to me she felt like she had gotten completely lost in the piece. And so Erica is now saying, you know, it's nice to have myself back 50% of the time, you know,
mm-hmm.
like to sort of have a schedule where I know that I've got some dedicated time to myself. And, you know, divorce is its own kind of headache and can be complicated and all those things. But, you know, autonomy is a very big deal. In the beginning, the physical annexation of your own body where, you know, you're nursing, you're exhausted, you know, you're sore and you hurt. I mean, all those things are very,
yeah.
very real.
Yeah.
And by the way, like a whole generation of mothers skipped nursing too, right? There was the bottle feeding frenzy for
That's
a while.
Right.
So,
That's right.
you know, and now there's immense pressure for, you know, health reasons and to nurse, and not everybody can, and, you know, then
right.
they feel bad. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of
yeah.
complex kind of forces that people are dealing with on this, you know, front.
Christy, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, let's go to Joe from Prairie Village. One more call before a break here. Joe, good morning. You're on with Jennifer Senior. She's the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Well, thanks, Joe.
Good, good. Well, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, my wife and I, having twins, it's definitely, for me, actually, it changed me to be learning to be a more patient man. You know, before I was rushing, I was always in a rush to do something, you know,
mm-hmm.
like get point A to point B. And now it's like, you know, we look at the kids, looking at the videos I took of them in the hospital. I barely remember holding them
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're
mm-hmm.
two, and, you know, freshly painted house is definitely added more crayons to it and markers and food and random spots. But, you know, I mean, we got to love that moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that's a great point, Joe. I'm glad you made it.
It's a delectably messy time. I mean, particularly if you can get into the pleasures that two-year-olds bring. I talk about this. I have a whole chapter in my book about the joys of very young kids.
Mm-hmm.
And among them are all these physical things that you're suddenly doing, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, the crayons and the markers. I mean, parents live in this world in their heads or in this estranged world from objects where they're, like, using touch screens and, you know, keyboards, and they're not painting and crayoning, and you know, it's really nice to hear, you know, you know, about that. And yes, some people do talk about the fact that their kids impose on them, they force them to be their better selves. We can't always do it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know, what I think happens is that, you know, sometimes kids make us become our finer selves, and sometimes, unfortunately, they draw out ugly parts of ourselves. You know, I mean,
they do.
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And then people feel terribly regretful about it. I mean, it can go all over the place, but it's great when people can say, "Look, this has really been a maturing experience for me." And there is like a subset of people for whom that is true. It just brings out the best in them.
Joe, thanks for the call. What effects have your kids had on you and your spouse and your life? 816-235-2888. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Jennifer Senior, author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. And Jennifer, let's talk in our second half about why parenting has changed so much, even in recent years, compared to the experiences that our parents had. How's that?
Love to.
Okay.
Perfect.
Time for a break. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're visiting with Jennifer Senior. She's the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She'll be speaking tomorrow night, Thursday evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch at 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. And we posted this question on our Twitter account. What effects have your kids had on you, your spouse, and your life? You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, Jennifer, why, you know, one of the main themes of your book is this notion of why parenting has changed as much as it has, even from the time, you know, when my parents were raising me. What's happened out there? Because, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that today's parents are way more engaged and kids are regarded as way more precious than they've ever used to be before.
Totally. Okay. Well, three big things.
Yes.
And
you about the three big factors. Yes.
Three big factors. And it's true. But just to pick up on something you said, right, it's true. You know, we as parents spend more time, I as a woman spend more time with my kid than women did in the 1960s, which,
mm-hmm.
if you think about it, is mind-blowing,
mm-hmm.
because most women during the, you know, 60s did not work, or did not, I shouldn't say it wasn't, I mean, it's terribly hard work raising a kid, but they were not in the workforce.
Yes.
So the three big things are, number one, well, choice. You know, we are now spacing apart our kids as we like. You know, the pill was a very big revolutionary thing to happen to us. We can, you know, birth control. And we're having fewer kids. So we assign a greater value to the kids that we have. And we put off having them, right? So, as I said, you know, you're 30.3, odds are, when you have your first kid, if you're a woman and you've been to college. So, you know, we now assign this, like, kind of epic value to having children and really emotionally invest a lot in the experience, the way the Jane Austen heroines used to think of marriage almost.
Uh-huh.
It's like this great, glorious thing at the end of the road. So that's number one. Number two, we work different, so we parent different.
Yeah.
And we work different in two ways. Number one, we can now work all the time thanks to email and, you know, everything.
Yes.
I've noticed.
Yes.
Have you noticed that?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Yes.
Funny, me too.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So if you're working all the time, here's the thing about working all the time. Then you have the ability to feel guilty all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the really perverse thing is that tons of parents will say that, you know, they feel like their kids are interrupting them while they're doing their email. And not the other way around, you know. And the other thing is that more women are in the workforce than ever before, and yet we still don't have, like, a good set of rules or scripts about how to divide the labor at home. So couples are fighting now that, you know, both people are, you know, both mom and dad are in the workforce. It's a recipe for real domestic tension.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the second thing. The third thing, and I think this is the biggest thing, and
yes.
no one really stops to think about it, is that the education-focused, sheltered American childhood as we know it is really a new invention. It really only came about post-World War II. And prior to that, kids worked. And this was not a particularly ethical arrangement. It was, in fact, a Dickensian arrangement mm-hmm. in the case of kids working in mines and mills and factories. When kids were working on farms, there was something considered more acceptable about it. It was character building and, you know, part of a family enterprise. But, you know, they were economic assets, is the point. They contributed money to the family till. But once we banned child labor, it became a very different ballgame. Rather than kids working for us, slowly but surely, we started working for them. And they went from being
yes,
our employees to our bosses, right?
Yep.
So, yes. And so here's what's so interesting. In the 1950s, it was not so expensive to raise a kid. You know, there was such a thing as a family wage. One person could earn income and another person could take care of the home front. The United States was not a particularly competitive place. The world had not yet begun to furiously globalize.
Mm-hmm.
By 70s, wages were stagnating. By the 90s, we were really seriously globalizing, and technology was kind of, you know, I think the pace of technological change was kind of starting to really accelerate. It got to the point now where, like, we don't feel like our kids have a chance unless we raise a whole generation of super children.
Mm-hmm.
And that is awfully difficult and creates a lot of labor for parents. So it's not that kids aren't working. They're still doing a lot of work. It's just that they're doing homework and they're going to soccer practice and they're taking violin and chess lessons. And that's not work that benefits the family. That is work that only benefits them. And we are doing it with them. We are the ones who are driving them to soccer practice. We are the one who are learning Suzuki violin along with them. We are the ones who are checking their homework. My mother didn't even have a passing acquaintance with my homework.
I'm all over that. Yes.
Yeah. All over it. Right?
I love this line from the book when you talk about sort of the confusion that sort of engulfs parents these days. This line is this: today, parents pour more capital, both emotional and literal, into their kids than ever before, and they're spending longer, more concentrated hours with their children than they once did. Yet, parents don't know what it is they're supposed to do precisely in their new jobs. So parents are more confused than ever.
Well, I mean, here's what's interesting. We in the United States in particular don't have a good set of folkways and traditions to rely on in terms of raising our kids. If you're part of a religious faith, it's easier. There are more scripts telling you what to do. But for people who are not as religious or even, and frankly, even if you are religious, I mean, the problem is, you know, two things. You get a lot of conflicting messages from those bookshelves about what you're supposed to do as a parent. One minute, you're supposed to be attachment parenting and all over your kid. And the next minute, you're supposed to be not attachment parenting because that would affect their resilience.
Yes.
You're supposed to be, right? You know, you're supposed to be making them bilingual in another language because that's really important. Okay, but now the question is which one? When I was growing up, I was told we had to learn Japanese. And you know what? It really didn't matter. I did not need to know Japanese.
Yeah.
Right. So now everybody's thinking, oh, it's got to be Mandarin. That's right now. That's what we think right now. You watch and you tell me in 10 years whether that's still useful. We don't know.
Yeah.
We have no idea. The world is changing so rapidly and the child rearing kind of conventional wisdom is changing so furiously that no one has a clue. No one has a clue. And so, you know, and I'll tell you something very funny. Margaret Mead, who was writing at exactly the moment the children were becoming sheltered,
mm-hmm.
you know, post-war, she noticed, and by the way, Dr. Spock was her pediatrician for her daughter, a fact I love to point out. she noticed that American parents were really gullible. Like, they just were willing to follow any dumb fad that you gave them. Because the beauty of the United States is that there are no scripts to follow. You can self-invent. But the problem is that you're not going to rely on your mother for child-rearing advice. You're going to go to the latest, most up-to-date source. So she had this quote saying, there are only this year's babies. And I think that that's exactly how parents feel. I mean, my mother tried to give me advice about how to raise my kid, and I looked at her cross-eyed like, that's crazy. Of course you're supposed to wake a sleeping baby, because if you don't, they're going to go into anabolic shock because you're not feeding them enough. And she was like, are you nuts? If your kid is sleeping, what on earth? I mean, you know, well, it'd be nice to have some folk wisdom and to feel like I could rely on my own mom. I mean, she did a fine enough job. I mean, look at me. I pay my taxes. I'm fine. You know?
Jennifer Senior's our guest. We're talking about modern parenthood and her new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Has being a parent been everything you hoped it would be? 816-235-2888. Roger from Kansas City, Missouri, Midtown. Good morning.
Good morning. My comment is, I know a lot of people stack their children within a two-year, three-year time frame. And we didn't. We did ours every 5 years. And I thought it was a lot better because we got time to actually develop that relationship with that child before the other one went off to school. You know, you get that interpersonal relationship. And that, to me, that's you know, that's all it's about.
That's interesting.
That is so lovely. And I got to tell you, I mean, unfortunately, social science studies are never that granular. But I've always wondered whether if they looked at parents who had done that, whether they would discover that their well-being went up. I mean, number one, you're pointing out something beautiful and very kind of, I don't know, there's a high EQ and kind of interpersonal dimension to that, which is like, I got to know my kid. Right. Which is really cool.
Right.
And they're starting to become a proto person. Right. When they have very singular personalities starting at about 3 and 4, like they're just these random little beings. And it's really great fun. The other thing is, like, you got personal recovery time. You got to get some of your sleep back.
Yeah. Right.
And you got to it probably was, there was just less pandemonium if you space them apart like that, because you can leave your 5 year old to go do other stuff.
One of the things we noticed was a lot of our friends just went broke buying diapers. If you've got three kids that are all in diapers, I mean, that's a huge financial bind.
Yeah.
You know, if you space them
out,
you know, we just didn't have the calamity or the, you know, financial.
How many kids did you have, Roger?
We've got three.
Mm-hmm.
So you started early enough to do that.
We started at 26.
Yeah.
You know, so it. You know, and the thing about it is, we've got friends that, you know, started in, you know, 20, 21, 22, and we've got friends that started at, you know, 35 to 40.
Yeah.
And so we've got kids that are our age, or that were our first kid's age, and we've got kids that are our last kid's age.
Right.
So it's wild. But,
also, that's cool because then you get like an intergenerational cohort of parents to hang out with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you're just going to have a big, that's really, really neat. And it just means starting earlier, but it's a very, I mean, I can see the advantages. I can also see how it would alleviate some of the economic tensions. I can just toss out a big scary number for everybody if they're interested in it. The Department of Agriculture every so often looks at how much it costs to raise a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So a kid born in 2010.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. You ready?
Yeah.
$295,000, not including college. And that's for a middle-class family. That's not for a poor family or a rich one.
Not including college. Now you really
stopped me there.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it would be nice to have, like, those pressures kind of spread out over time.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm paying for college right now, so I'm the wrong guy to ask about all of this. Roger, thanks for the good call. I appreciate it. Krista from Blue Springs. Krista, good morning.
Hi. I just want to make a comment how I've heard, I've always had this feeling, but I heard it described in a unique way. I had three children, and it's like you have, you know, the proverbial heartstrings, three heartstrings pulling your heart in three ways, and then someone described it as an instance of your heart out there walking around in the world in each of your children. And I think that reflects our vulnerability as parents.
I have that in my book. The person I attribute it to, and I thought it was he who said it, I'd like to think that I, you know, helped move it into common circulation. Christopher Hitchens said it in his autobiography. Christopher Hitchens was not a sentimental man, and he was not a sentimental writer. The one sentimental thing that he said in his book that I thought was just unbelievably beautiful in his memoir, Hitch 22, was that having a kid, it's like somebody else's, your heart is running around in someone else's body. And I just found that
That's
so
great.
Apt.
That's great.
Yeah. Another one is,
okay,
you know, that we are.
Much.
Thanks, Krista.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jennifer.
No, there's another one, and I can't remember who said it, but it was that we're hostages to fortune, which can mean, you can read it in a number of ways, but one is that, you know, we now, you know, our fates are deeply intertwined with someone else's.
Yeah, absolutely. Julia from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on with Jennifer Sr. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, my son is grown, but I remember one of the challenges as a parent was being able to answer his questions, which were unlimited, at an age-appropriate level where he didn't get frustrated and I didn't get frustrated. I remember one of the questions he asked when he was about four was, we were driving on a bitterly cold night, clear, cold, as only Kansas City can be cold, and he looked up at the moon and he said, "Mom, how does the moon stay warm?"
Oh, and that's so great.
I had no idea, you know, and I said, "Oh, well, honey, the clouds kind of cuddle up and keep it warm." So for the longest time, this child had the idea that the moon was close enough to the clouds. But as he grew older, the science took over and he realized that I had told a story.
That's a wonderful, wonderful story, Julia.
Yeah, it's a beautiful answer to a beautiful question.
Yes, great answer.
So in my third chapter, I talk about this too, again, speaking to the joys of young kids. And your son is just in that age range. Between the ages of like 3 and 7, it turns out that kids ask lots and lots of questions that professional philosophers, you know, tenured people at universities tend to think about for a living.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, they ask things like, what is time? What is water? You know, all these things here, you know, like, how is the moon, you know, how does the moon stay warm? And, you know, your response to a four-year-old can't be, well, actually, it has, you know, almost no atmosphere. And it's really icily cold and brutal. And, you know, I mean, it's a lifeless wasteland that's merely a rock. I mean, you can't say that. But, you know, at some point, I mean, I don't know how parents answered these questions before Google.
Right.
You want to be able to give an answer.
Remember. Yeah. Once he was, he's, like I said, he's grown, so we didn't have touch screens back then. He was actually playing with a real globe, those little cheap metal globes you could buy. And I was pointing out the different places where his relatives lived. And then he turned the globe and he pointed to China and he said, "Who lives there and what are their names?"
How long did that answer take? Yeah.
One I had no response for.
Mm-hmm.
Those are really difficult questions. I mean, actually, I'm thinking of something, I'm flashing on something that my own son said when, in New York, kids eventually come around earlier than you'd like to learning about what happened on September 11th. And my son was very preoccupied with good and evil and very afraid of it. And he at some point wanted to know what bad people looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Like he wanted to know, you know, if they had a face and, you know, if they, he asked, I guess when he was four, he said, are they robots?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I mean, it was a really, I mean, these can be very hard questions. By the way, the moon has no atmosphere. I don't know why I said it had almost none, but I think it's because it has some gravity. And I was, anyway,
that's okay.
Just thinking for any scientist who is listening, like
this
they're just going to be like,
show,
wow,
Jennifer.
That girl's an idiot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but you know, these can be, and so I can see how these questions can be very bedeviling. They also, though, can be really fun. I mean, to me, this is like the whole ball game because it would never occur to you. I mean, it says something about the way the human brain works that your son said, like, oh, well, who lives there and what are their names? That shows kind of the shape of his world. Everybody in his world at 3 or 4 still had a name.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't occur to him that the world was larger and nameless. I mean, it's very kind of beautiful to think about how small and containable life still seemed and how manageable it was to him then.
Julia, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting to me, you know, Jennifer, we're talking here, our focus has been on young kids in those magical ages, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, when they're the world's exploding in their minds and all that. You also talk in this book about sort of the flip side of the coin, which is the teenage years, which yours truly is in the midst of right now with my two boys. And you wonder, you know, they don't ask questions anymore. They don't really talk to you unless they absolutely have to. And you do wonder at times if there's anything left left of the relationship. You say what in your book about the struggles of these years? And please help. Be kind.
Yes. Oh, God. Yes. No, no, no. They're tough. I mean, they're really hard.
Really tough.
Right. Not only are they not asking questions, but they're pretty convinced they have all the answers.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's
absolutely.
Based on, like, only 10 minutes worth of experience, right? It's not like they've lived a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, yeah, it's really hard. But I think what the crisis for parents in the teen years, first of all, if you're struggling, you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
It seems funny to say, but parents seem to go through as much of a crisis during adolescence as their kids,
yes.
if not more of
one. I was really struck by that in your book, and that's so well said, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, I think that's the first thing they have to know. The second thing they have to know is that this is very real. What happens is that as kids pull away, what they're doing is exposing the holes in their parents' lives. When your kid was still cuddling up with you and bounding up to see you when you walked through the door, you know, you got a lot of extra fuel from those interactions that you probably weren't aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Then they pull away, they individuate, they do what's, you know, age appropriate, and suddenly you are left going, wow, well, is my spouse going to give me this kind of positive reinforcement?
Yeah.
Wait,
mm-hmm.
she's not. Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
Is my work? They're kind of hostile over there in that cubicle. I don't know. You know, like, are my friends? Is my church? Is my synagogue? You know, like, you kind of race through these other things and, like, wonder whether they are there to give you the support you need. So that's, like, a big, I think that's a moment of real reckoning. And just more generally, you're wondering about the life choices you've made, right? I mean, your kid's pulling away. So now you get to look back from, you know, you're sort of looking at 10,000 feet and saying, did I choose well? Did I raise this kid in a way that, you know, they're now starting to become a proto person,
mm-hmm.
you know, and do
mm-hmm.
I like the choices I made? It's hard. It's,
yeah.
it's a real moment of existential reckoning.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go back to some calls here. Let's go to Aaron from Kansas City, Kansas. Aaron, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I was going to comment back to the beginning of my daughter's 10 weeks old, and I am back to work and the primary breadwinner, and so we're having some, you were talking earlier about gender roles and things like that in the household, and we've been pretty flexible with ours, but it's been a very enlightening to me to be the mom, the primary breadwinner, returning back to work, and my husband being home with baby more often. But then also on the flip side of that, we try and, you know, got your back kind of thing with taking care of the baby. And when I am home, trying to give him his time away to be out and have that sense of self and time with friends and things like that, to where even when we're both technically home, we don't have a lot of time to spend together. And so it's been a challenge to have our time that as a married couple again.
Yeah.
Couple time really suffers in the beginning. You get it back, you know, for what it's worth. You will find, you know, your coupledom, you know, kind of returning to you. But it takes a while. Couples spend less time together than they did in the 1970s, you know, together. So we have different habits now, too, where we sweep in our children into, you know, a lot of family activities, whereas moms and dads used to go out alone, you know, in the 70s in particular. Your husband is part of a growing legion of men who are, you know, spending more time at home, and you are part of a growing legion of women who are, like, the primary breadwinners, you know. And in 2012, there was a brief moment when women even overtook men in the workforce. I mean, this is all—we have to negotiate all of this. We still don't have rules and scripts. So the more you can talk about it, the more open and granular it can be about, like, what rules you want to have, and the better off you are. It sounds like you're off to a really good rip-roaring start. One thing for your husband to know— he should find other dads. It's really hard.
Yeah. Good advice. Aaron, good luck to you. And again, Jennifer Senior, her new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. You can see her hear her again tomorrow night, 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street, kclibrary.org for more information. Jennifer, you have been just terrific. I've really enjoyed my time with you. Just a great conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a cracking conversation.
Great.
Fabulous.
I'm glad. Yeah. Thanks, Jennifer. All the best.
Thank you.
You bet.
You too.